We're recording now, so I get to use the microphone, but I have to still hold my Bible, so I don't know how this is going to work. I might drop one or the other, or both. Beautiful day, right? I was on the way to the gym this morning. There's all kinds of people out jogging and running on motorcycles and bikes, and you know, like, the Meadows is probably just packed with people laying out on blankets and stuff. But you have chosen to be here, so to quote Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, you have chosen wisely. All right. We're going to be continuing our series today in the book of Joshua. We're going to be working in chapter 2. We're going to be spending a great deal of time talking about Rahab, who she is, what she believes, and what she does. We're also going to talk a bit about courage. Our guiding verse for this sermon series on Joshua is Joshua 1:9. Be strong and courageous. Don't be terrified, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. Probably heard that last week. But what does courage look like? And is it the same for everybody? That's what we're going to be getting into today. So we're going to start here in verse 1. Then Joshua, son of Nun, secretly sent two spies from Shittim. Go look over the land, he said, especially Jericho. So they went and entered the house of a prostitute named Rahab and stayed there. Two things here, Jericho and Rahab. First off, Jericho. Why Jericho? Jericho is a very important town. From a military perspective, it had a strategic location. It was very well fortified. It was a center of trade. It was a very wealthy city. I have an image here. That's a satellite image we have of Jericho at the time. Come on, that was funny. A satellite image? This was 4,000 years ago. Anyway, this is an artist rendering of Jericho. The nice weather slows you guys down. And you can see, I mean, this is kind of what they think Jericho most likely looked like. A really, really large city, very heavily fortified. Big, thick curtain wall all the way around, interior wall. Let's say it was a center of trade. It was a hub of activity. If you were going to live in this land, which is the land that the Israelites were being called to, you couldn't just skip over Jericho, right? They had their own fortifications. They had their own army. They had a king and the whole deal. Jericho had to be dealt with. So he sends his spies to go to Jericho. So here we have talking about Jericho. The second thing is Rahab. Rahab is a prostitute. So what does that label mean? What does it mean to label somebody by what they do? Your profession does not identify who you are. This past week, my family and I went to Oban. I keep mispronouncing that. It's as bad as Inverness. Okay, we went to Oban, and we met up with a friend of my daughter's. They went to school together, and then her mom remarried and moved to Glasgow. So we try to let the kids get together whenever they can. And I've met my daughter's friend, obviously, and I've met her mother, but I never had the chance to meet her new husband, Steve. So this trip was my first chance to meet Steve. And we went on a little island tour together. We went to Iona and Spray or something else like that. I don't know. A couple of islands out there in the really cold water of the East Sea. And we spent the whole day together. It was like an 8-hour tour, like 8-9 hours. You know, had various conversations, you know, about the grave sites we were seeing and the ruins in Iona and so forth. I mean, 8-9 hours, we ate a couple of meals together, spent a lot of time talking. So we get back at the end of the tour and we go our separate ways. They get in their car to head back to Glasgow and we go back to our flat that we rented. And Deanna and I were talking and she mentions that Steve builds kitchens. He works in construction. He like redesigns and remodels home kitchens. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. And she goes, how could you not know what he does for a living? Isn't that like the second question guys always ask each other? And I was like, you know what? Yeah, that's kind of right. You know, first time you meet somebody, you're like, hey, what's your name? Yeah, what do you do for a living? We always attach people's identities to what they do for a living, right? Because they have a certain criteria for different professions. you meet somebody for the first time, like, oh, so what do you do? Like, well, I'm a pastor. Okay, well, I have this list of criteria, these list of expectations that I think of, that I associate with that profession, so I can help identify you and I can help figure you out a little bit. You know, I'm a doctor. I work in IT. You know, whatever. We use that to label people so we can say, okay, this is probably what you're going to be about. And it occurred to me, I never asked Steve that question, because several years ago, it started really bothering me that that's how I always introduce myself to other people. I would ask that question all the time. That's what you know, so what do you do? And then the inevitable question would go like, oh, well, what do you do? It's like, well, I'm a restaurant manager. Does that really mean like that's who I am? No. But we get labeled that way because that's what the world tells us how we're supposed to be. It tells us who we are. How do you make your money? How do you make your living? What is it that brings that cash into your bank account? Because that's what's most important about you. That's how I'm going to find out what kind of a person you are when I can find out what you do for a living, what your job is. That's a worldly way to label people. And that's what we have here with Rahab. Because there's a worldly label, there's what the world tells us we are, and then there's what God tells us we are. See, people are not one-dimensional. You have many, many different facets to your personality. There are many things that God has gifted you with and God directs you with. And your profession is not the only thing that tells you who you are. So even though we initially see Rahab as a prostitute, the lowest in the social order of a moral society, she turns out to be a lot more. You can see here in verse 2 and 3. The king of Jericho was told, look, some of the Israelites have come here tonight to spy out the land. So the king of Jericho sent this message to Rahab. Bring out the men who came to you and entered your house, because they have come to spy out the whole land. Think about this for a second. Think about who sent the message, what this person knows, and what it means to Rahab and her family. The king of Jericho sends these guys to her house. That's a pretty big deal. She's a prostitute, remember? I mean, she's on the bottom rung of society. And while she more than likely had some kind of contacts with people who worked in the court, she certainly would never have had any contact with the king. The king is not going to be hanging out down the red light district of Jericho, right? This is someone who she would more than likely never have any contact with in her entire life, but someone under whose authority she's been probably since she was born. A very, very important figure. And this king sends people to her house directly to say, we know these spies came here, and we know they came to your house. And they're coming here to spy out the whole land. They're not coming here to shop for a flat. They're coming here to see what our defenses look like so their armies can come in, destroy this city, ravage this whole place, and kill everybody you know. And we know they came here. So where are they? Put this in context for a second. Let's say you have a couple of Russian visitors pop over to your house one day. Somebody you think is a coworker or something like that. And then Theresa May sends two people from MI6 to your front door and says, hey, those two Russians that came to visit you, yeah, they're actually here to set off a nuclear device, so where are they? That's essentially what we're talking about here. The king of Jericho sends the people and says, we know they're here. I mean, she very easily could have just been, they could have like thrown her in with them. Like, you're obviously colluding with these spies. We know they came to your house, right? That's a scary situation for anyone to be in. So let's see what she does. Verses 4 to 7. But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. She said, yes, the men came to me, but I didn't know where they had come from. At dusk, when it was time to close the city gate, they left. I don't know which way they went, but go after them quickly. You may catch up with them. But she had taken them up to the roof and hidden them under the stalks of flax that she had laid out on the roof. So the men set out in pursuit of the spies on the road that leads to the fords of the Jordan. And as soon as the pursuers had gone out, the gate was shut. She lies to her king and hides these people. She didn't have to. She could have very easily ratted them out. I mean, they weren't like standing behind the door with a gun pointed at her head. They were up on the roof, hiding under some flax. We see that later on in the middle of the verse. She could have really easily just pointed up and says, they're up there. Go get them. right? She probably would have been rewarded. No risk to herself whatsoever. She may have got a few gold coins, maybe even stopped being a prostitute. She could have done something else with her life. That's not what she does. She hides them. She protects them. She covers them. And this is where it gets tricky. Because this is where the courage comes in. You see, we often think of courage as this. Right? It's a soldier on the front line. It's a firefighter going into a burning building. You know, a warrior preparing for battle. Right? We think of courage as courageous, somebody who's like brave beyond fear. You know? But courage is not fearlessness. The 82nd Airborne, the paratrooper division, 508th Infantry in the United States, has a definition of courage. And they say to be courageous is not to be unafraid. To be courageous is to be afraid, but go ahead anyway. To be courageous is to have fear, but still do what you need to do to get things done. That's what these people here do. How do we do that? How do we go ahead even though we may be scared to death? We do it through faith. And faith can mean a lot of different things for a lot of different people. It could be faith in your own abilities. If you're going to go start a new job, perhaps in a foreign country, you may be a bit nervous about that. It may be something scary, maybe something new, maybe your first job out of uni. But you go anyway, you step out and you do it because you have faith in your own abilities. You know you can do the job. You've had the training, you've had the education, you know you can do it. Or people like this, often it's faith in their friends, faith in their comrades, faith in their fellow soldiers. There's a book called When We Were Soldiers Once and Young. They made a movie out of it with Mel Gibson. It's a pretty good movie, actually. But the guy who wrote this book was a lieutenant colonel in the Vietnam War. And he said the reason he wrote this book is because he said, whenever Hollywood does a movie about war, they always get it wrong. He said they always portray soldiers going out to fight for their country. You know, they go to fight for their country, fight for their flag. He's like, that's not it. Soldiers in the field don't fight for their country. They fight for each other. It's their faith in their friends that carries them through. It's their faith in, you know, if me and Homan are jumping out of a plane together, I'm going to be scared to jump out of a plane. But if I know Homan's got my back, I'll go. Because I know there's someone there to care for me, someone there to watch out for me. I have faith in my comrade. For Rahab, it was faith in something bigger than that. It was faith in something bigger than her king, bigger than her king's army, faith in something bigger than that massive wall that everyone in the whole area was afraid of. And this faith was not instilled by these two spies who came to visit her. Just think about these two guys that just came to her house, right? Two spies that Joshua sends out. A couple of young guys, they're sent on a military mission to go get reconnaissance information. And what do? First place they go to? Prostitute's house. You don't get a whole lot of military information going to visit a prostitute, right? So two young guys sent on a military mission, the first thing they do is go to the red light district. That doesn't instill a lot of confidence in one. Her faith is in something else. We can see here, verses 8 to 11. Before the spies lay down for the night, she went up on the roof and said to them, I know that the Lord has given you this land, and that a great fear of you has fallen on us, so that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. We have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to Sihon and Og, the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, whom you completely destroyed. When we heard of it, our hearts melted in fear, and everyone's courage failed because of you. For the Lord your God is God in heaven above and on earth below. Her act of courageousness was done in fear of God. See, it's not, you know, because your army is so mighty or because your generals are so smart. It's because your God is with you. She had gods too. Gods were everywhere in the ancient Near East. they were largely local. Like, you know, they had a certain area that they were in charge of. You know, you had Molech over here, you had Dagon over there. You go to different places, a different god, right? But she says, your God is God in heaven above and on earth below. Your God is everywhere. Your God is powerful. Your God is awesome. Your God is not restricted to these local areas. And on top of that, your God destroys all these other local gods. While everyone else in the city was melting in fear because of these reports, she was believing. She was convinced of the power and the might of God. She says, I know your God has given you this land. That's an important statement. Remember, there was a God over the city. There was a God over this area. Any other God would not have any jurisdiction or power there. But she says, I know your God has given you this land. Your God is more powerful than these other gods that are around here. And how do we know that it was belief in God and not just fear of the army? Well, because of what she asked next. Let's see in verses 12 and 13. There we go. Back. 12 and 13? It's going crazy! Okay. Luckily, I have a Bible here, so I can just read verses 12 and 13. That's probably my fault. I made the PowerPoint. We'll blame it on me. All right. Okay. Now then, please swear to me by the Lord that you will show kindness to my family, because I have shown kindness to you. Give me a sure sign that you will spare the lives of my father, my mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and that you will save us from death. Now, a couple of things here. First, kindness. Evan, go to the next one. There we go. The word kindness there is the Hebrew term chesed. Let me say that fast three times. That's fun. Chesed. Okay? Chesed means loving kindness, benevolence, goodness in relation to God. It is a covenantal love. It's not kindness as in, look, I'm being nice to you. How about you be nice to me and not kill me when you guys come back? What she's saying there is she's saying out of loving kindness and goodness, I have offered you this covering, right? I want the same kind of covering from your God. She says to swear by the Lord your God that you will show me this kindness, this covenantal covering. This term, chesed, is used actually several places in the Old Testament. We see in Jeremiah 31:3. We have that one. The Lord appeared to us in the past, saying, I have loved you with an everlasting love. I have drawn you with unfailing kindness. And that kindness, the word again there, that's chesed. That is God saying, I have drawn you with this kindness. I have given you my covering and my protection. That's what she's asking for from their God. And now, you can't miss the second part of this verse. Because she gets the covering for herself and her family. Mother, father, brothers, sisters, and all who belong to them. This prostitute, through faith in God, is bringing her family under God's protection. She has no position to do this. She has no authority. But she steps out in faith. And what is the result? We see in verse 14, our lives for your lives, the men assured her. If you don't tell what we are doing, we will treat you kindly and faithfully when the Lord gives us the land. She has a promise. She gets an assurance. Her courage, born of faith in God, is rewarded by a promise. And this would seem to be like a happy ending, right? If we just stopped right there. She hears about God, receives God's message, believes on God, and is given the assurance of salvation. It's basically, it's an Old Testament account of what many of us as New Testament Christians have experienced, right? You hear the message of God, you believe God, you have faith in God, and you get salvation, you get covering, you get covenantal love and protection from the Lord. And if it ended here, and we were all happy and safe, then that'd be great. But in her story, as in most of ours, there is often some postscript. There are two things here that I want to draw your attention to. In verses 15 to 19. So she let them down by a rope through the window, for the house she lived in was part of the city wall. She said to them, "Go to the hills so the pursuers will not find you. Hide yourselves there 3 days until they return, and then go on your way." Now the men said to her, "This oath you made us swear will not be binding on us unless when we enter the land you have tied this scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down, and unless you have brought your father and mother, your brothers, and all your family into your house. If any of them go outside your house into the street, their blood will be on their own heads. We will not be responsible." So first of all, her house. Her house is in the city wall. Now, spoiler alert, these walls are going to come crashing down. Sorry to ruin that surprise for you if you didn't know that story already. We'll get to that here in a couple chapters about the walls of Jericho crashing down. But the walls are going to be destroyed. Her house is in the wall. Now, of course, she doesn't know this yet. She has no idea that God's going to miraculously intervene and destroy these walls. But her house is in the wall right next to the main city gate. Even barring the miraculous occurrence of the walls coming crashing down, she has to know that any army that attacks is going to be attacking at the main gate and attacking the walls. Her house is right there. Her house is going to be destroyed, or at the very least, heavily damaged, right? This is not, you know, cool, I'm going to be safe. I'm going to have all my stuff be safe. I'm going to have this little protective bubble around where I live. No, that's not how things worked back then. There was going to be fire. There was going to be stones thrown. There was going to be people fighting right outside her door. Her house was going to have some serious, serious damage at the very least. Second thing, there's going to be a lot of blood in the streets. It's her and her family who have this protection. Her and her family who are going to be looked out after the Israelites. Nobody else. Nobody else gets this deal. Which means everyone else in the city, everyone else she knows, could be dead, maimed, or at the very least homeless after this attack happens. And sure, I mean, she's a prostitute. She's not looked at very highly among the population of this city, but surely she knows some people there she's not related to. She has some friends, the little lady upstairs she borrows sugar from or whatever. You know, and these people are going to be killed, maimed, destroyed, set on fire. Houses are going to be looted. Children are going to be left fatherless. A lot of kids are going to get orphaned. This is not going to be a quick and easy thing where everything is all safe and fun. Death, destruction, chaos. Her life is going to be turned upside down. And after she gets this news, right, she has to wait 3 days. When she lets the spies go and they go in the hideout, they're out there for 3 days before she goes back. Her faith has got to be tested, right? I mean, 3 days with no reassurance. It's not like, you know, every 4 or 5 hours, you know, an angel of the Lord pops into her flat and goes, "Hey, don't forget, I got you covered. You're set. You're good. You feel set? You feel good? Okay, bye." It's not happening. For 3 days, I mean, you know she has to have some second thoughts. For those 3 days, she has to act like everything is normal. She still goes to the market, sees kids playing in the streets, starts thinking, wow, you know, these kids could be orphans in a couple of days. Some nice guy, you know, picks up something she drops as she's walking to the market and gives it to her. And she's like, "Oh, what a sweet man. He's probably going to be headless in about 2 days. Maybe I made the wrong decision. Maybe I did the wrong thing. Maybe I could still go to the king and say, 'Hey, look, I know where those spies are. They're hiding out in the hills right there.' Then everyone might be safe and she would get rewarded." But she maintains her faith. She has faith and she still has the promise. And her act of faith actually accomplishes the mission that the two spies were sent out to do. We see in verses 22 to 24. When they left, they went to the hills and stayed there for the 3 days until the pursuers had searched all along the road and returned without finding them. Then the two men started back. They went down to the out of the hills, forded the river, and came to Joshua, son of Nun, and told him everything that happened to them. They said to Joshua, "The Lord has surely given us the whole land into our hands, and all the people are melting in fear because of us." The only intelligence these two spies gathered was what Rahab told them. Remember, I mean, they went to a brothel and hid. That was it. That was their big mission. You know, instead of going out and scouting out where the sentries were on the walls, or checking out the wall's thickness or the wall's composition, or maybe trying to count the soldiers inside the city, or seeing how their ranks are divided or what their training is like, or talk to some people in to see what the tradesmen are doing and things like that. All the things that a spy normally would do, all the things that a military scout should do, they did none of that. They showed up and were like, "Oh, there's a brothel." Doesn't accomplish a whole lot. So she sheltered them, she protected them, and then she fulfilled their mission for them. She gave them the information about the city that they could take back to Joshua. So what does this all mean for us? What does her story have to tell us? Well, quite simply, God can cover you and protect you and your house even when your world is falling down. You just need to have faith. The promise of God is a real thing. And you don't have to be like, you know, Sister Super Christian to call upon the kindness of God. Her label, her position, what the world told her she was, did not stop her from acting in faith for her family. She threw off that label and stepped out in faith. Didn't matter what the world thought of her or what her name tag said. The only thing that mattered was God. The first person in my family to get saved was my mom. It was very late in life. But as soon as she received the Lord, she began praying for me and my sisters to accept Christ as well. You know, she earnestly praying for us and my oldest sister's husband at the time, you know, for us all to receive the blessing of the Lord, receive the Lord's covenantal protection, right? And a lot of people looked at that and said, "Who are you to be asking God for that?" We grew up in kind of difficult circumstances. My mom made some unfortunate choices when she was younger. Her first three husbands were abusive, alcoholic, drug addicts, and she was a codependent. So we moved around quite a bit and suffered a lot of trauma because, you know, she stayed with these guys. And a lot of people looked at that and said, "Well, look what you did to your family. Look how you raised your children." You know, I mean, I was going to biker parties by the time I was 8 years old. You know, that's not like a normal kid thing, right? So a lot of people labeled my mom and were like, you know, "What? Whatever. After all that stuff you did, you know, after what you put your kids through, you think you have any right for this?" But she kept praying. She kept doing it. She kept every day wake up at 5:30 in the morning and spend an hour praying for her kids. And at the time, my oldest sister, she had a kid out of wedlock, and the guy she was with, she wasn't married to. He was a Hindu. And my other sister was married to an alcoholic. Me and my one other sister, my mom was married a few times. My dad was married a few times. So there's quite a few steps and half siblings. I'm not going to go through all of them. But suffice it to say, none of us were making very good life choices at the time, right? But today, well, I mean, first of all, I'm up here, okay? My oldest sister, the one who was shacking up with the Hindu guy, you guys have met them. They came here a couple years ago for a visit. They're going to be here this Sunday. They were both saved. They got married. They've both been serving in ministry together for about 20 years. Both my other sisters, same thing. My sister's alcoholic husband gave up drinking, went to rehab. He and Melissa both got saved. Both their children serve in ministry as well. My other sister Jennifer and her husband, you know, they serve in ministry. And all of this, you know, because my mom just started praying. Even though everybody said, you know, you got no right to be doing that, she maintained it. And my mom, like Rahab, was courageous because her faith in God allowed her to be courageous. It was her faith of God, her fear of God, that allowed her to be courageous and step out in faith for her family. So maybe you have some Rahab moments in your life. Maybe God sending his messengers to you to break down your walls and upturn your life. Maybe the world is labeling you to keep you from acting. Maybe people are saying, you're a responsible professional. You can't do that kind of thing. You can't go serve in ministry. You can't lift up God so high in your own home. You've got kids you have to worry about. Or maybe you feel foolish, circling your family up to pray in public or wearing your faith at work. There are a million walls that we live in that can restrict us. God still wants in. We just have to have the courage of faith to listen and then act. Don't melt in fear. Be a Rahab and act courageously. What has God asked you to be courageous about? What is God asking you to do? And if you've not heard from God, if you don't know where God is calling you to step out and be courageous, maybe that should be your prayer today, that God would reveal that to you so you can hear God's messengers. There are acts of courage for all of us. The key is to act. Let's pray. Lord God, as we hear your word today, and we hear the story of Rahab that you have preserved for us in your holy word, I pray, Lord, that it would speak to our lives, that you would reach down and touch us, God. If there are acts of courage that you would call us to in our fear and faith of you, Lord, I pray that you would just make those known to us, Lord. Let us hear the messengers you have for us, God, so we can break down those walls and act as you have called us to act. I pray this in the name of your Son, our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen.